The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, a couple of announcements before I begin the talk. First is that I'll have a community meeting on Zoom tomorrow morning after the 7 a.m. sitting and Dharma talk, so it'll be at 7:45 or so. And it's partly to commemorate the one-year anniversary of starting the 7 a.m. sittings. And it's also, for many of us, Mark's commemorates also the one-year anniversary of sheltering in place, where our life has changed dramatically a year ago. And different places, of course, went into shelter at different times, but at least here in California, a year ago. It's been a big year, and I almost was going to give a talk today about grief. And maybe I'll do that in a couple of weeks, but I wasn't quite ready for that. And then next week, I won't be here. Next week, a wonderful teacher, Amana Johnson, is going to speak. She is she graduated a year and a half ago from the teacher training at Spirit Rock. So she's a local Dharma teacher, and very happy to have her come and spend Sunday morning with you. So imagine that you're in a beautiful place in nature, that maybe some place you've been and found inspiring, and maybe far away from buildings and roads and a lot of people, and it's just an expanse of natural setting, beautiful, comfortable, safe, inspiring place to be. And maybe it's so inspiring, maybe you visit regularly to appreciate and feel the freedom of just roaming around, and the trees and the skies and the hills and the rivers and the lakes, whatever it might be, just a vast space that's wonderful to be in. And so after visiting many times, you think this is special, and you want to kind of mark the specialness of it some nice way and creative way. And so you bring with you into the wilderness a glass door with a frame. It's a bit of an effort to bring it in there. And you install that door right in the middle of the wilderness, this glass door. It swings open very nicely at its frame. And there it is, this door, middle of the wilderness. Some people might think it's an art installation. But it's your door. It kind of marks that this space, this place, is so special for you. It's kind of like marking it as being special, and that symbolically it's a door into a different landscape and different place. But now when you go visit in this big, vast, open space, there in the middle there's a door. And you happen to put it right in the middle of a trail, so that when you go in the trail, you have to open the door and step through. So the door is there, and you like this door, and sometimes it gets locked by mistake, and you have to go home and get the key to unlock it, and sometimes it gets rusty being in the weather, and you have to oil it so that it can open and close, and being a glass door, sometimes it gets dirty, and you have to clean it, and you care for this door. And after a while, you think of this door as your door. And you want to protect your door. And so you, because the door represents this openness into this wilderness and this freedom that's there. And so you decide that the thing to do is to put a fence around the door to really protect it so the moose doesn't come along and knock it down. And, and break the glass. So you put the fence around it, and you come out there, and you feel, oh, my door is protected. And after a while, you start feeling, you look around, say, well, this place where I enclose with a fence is not really big enough for me. It's I'd like more space to be able to come in and just kind of be spacious and open. And so you expand the fence, make it bigger and bigger. And after a while, you don't want to really see the fence. You make the fence really big and goes around the hills and outside of view. And so you go inside, just you and the door. And the door is kind of maybe sometimes gets branches fall on it and break it, and you fix it. And all kinds of things happen to that door. And eventually you wonder about the door, and then you remove the door, and then there's vast open space again. Then you remove the fence, and it's just like it was before. It's still a beautiful, beautiful location, inspiring and peaceful, wonderful to roam around in. And then you think, what was I doing with the door? What was I doing with the fence? So this may be a little silly story. Is introduction to the topic today, which is the Buddha's teachings on selfishness. The earliest teachings of the Buddha, as best we know, he did not teach anything about not-self, famous teachings of the Buddha. It wasn't his focus, but rather he was focused on talking about the problems and the suffering around being selfish and how a wise person let go of selfishness. And as he developed his teaching, he described three different ways of being selfish or self-focused or self-preoccupied in some way. And one was through craving, one was through conceit, and the other is through metaphysical opinions and views, beliefs that we hold on to. So the craving idea of selfishness, he associates with possessiveness, possessing things. These are mine. This is mine. The conceit is associated with the idea of I am, that I am something. That I am this, I am that. So it's a role, identities that we take on and hold on to. And the third is this is myself. This is a true self. Now I know what the self is, and this is what the self is, what my true self is, my essence is. And in Pali, these little expressions appear a lot in the suttas. It's etad mama, eso aham asmi, and eso me ata. And it's kind of close to what we say in English of me, myself, and mine. But he kind of says it in reverse. This is mine, this I am, and this is myself. This is the self. So, and the reason to notice this and pay attention to it, it's the domain, the qualities of selfishness, of being caught up in excessive preoccupation with oneself, a strong attachment, clinging, self-centeredness that can happen. And this movement towards selfing and holding on to self is limits our freedom. It does something which is not really necessary to cling to the self, that is comparable to this idea, if you will, if you allow me, of putting this door right in the middle of the wilderness. The wilderness was beautiful and wonderful by itself, and it was a wonderful place to visit and peaceful and relaxing, and it was so much more less complicated to be there when you didn't have to take care of the door and protect the door and repair the door and build fences around the door. And so the same thing, the natural, kind of a natural state of being that can be quite open and peaceful and inspiring to experience for oneself, that it doesn't require placing something in the middle. This is mine. This is who I am. This is myself. That movement is kind of an extra movement that places something in the natural setting, which more often than not does not need it, especially if what we're doing is clinging and holding on to these things. So conventionally, we might say things are mine, you know, it's a lot. We say it. It's you know, things are mine. Things are legally mine. There's ownership. There's things which we allow each other to have, but the selfishness around that is when we cling to mine. We hold on to it for dear life. Like it has to be this way. And this movement towards possessiveness and claiming things as mine, this belongs to me, is a recipe for suffering. The one famous myth, kind of origin story in Buddhism, that the beginning of the one of the beginnings of the downturn of the of society was private property, and then people started hoarding in their private property and stealing, and things got out of hand in this mythic story. So the idea of it's mine and holding it tight, not realizing that possessions of all kinds, anything we can say is mine, is fragile, is temporary, is there's no guarantee that it's going to stay around. That I read recently about a meteorite or asteroid that kind of landed in the driveway of someone in, I think in Scotland, I think it was, or somewhere. And a rare mineral that came in this asteroid. And but there's no, you know, guarantee that lightning's not going to strike us or strike our thing, strike our car or bicycle. An asteroid's not going to fall on something we own. And then we don't own it anymore. It's gone. You know, it just becomes a squashed piece of burnt stuff. And the idea that it is me, myself, and that it's mine has disappeared. Recently I broke a bowl, a ceramic bowl that my son had made, a beautiful bowl, and I broke it in the kitchen, and it was ours, belonged to our family. But soon as it was broken, I didn't really think of it anymore as mine, or I didn't think of it as belonging to my family. I rather unceremoniously just kind of put it in the trash, and off it went. And so mine. I love the story that's of Suzuki Roshi. I've told it many times. Of Suzuki Roshi is there's a photograph of him actually saying this, that taken just as he was saying it, so it's kind of more poignant. He was a photograph of him holding up his glasses like this, and he says, "These are not my glasses, but you know about my old tired eyes, so you let me use them." So that's a very different relationship to my glasses. And so certainly it's convenient to have things that we use and know they're there and they're reliably going to be there next day when we find them, and so we're seeing their mind. But you might reflect a little bit about how much extra attachment there might be, possessiveness, fear of safety, fear of not being safe, attachment to status, attachment to all kinds of things that come. We say something is mine. It gets more kind of interesting when you look at that we take as mine traits of our personality or qualities of our physique and our body and ways that we are in the world. Opinions, my opinions. And if we hold on to those and cling to those and think they're unchanging, we'll suffer. So there's suffering of taking things as mine. And for the Buddha, it was very explicit. Even taking this body as mine is a recipe for more suffering. And so, you know, isn't it natural and normal to take this body as mine? I think it's natural, normal, conventionally to take it as mine, my body. But to do so with an open hand, not clinging to it, just lightly, provisionally. But as soon as you say my body, that I, you know, then I have to be in charge of it, and it can't change, and it has to always stay the same. Maybe. The second form of selfishness is conceit. And this is the idea of over-evaluating oneself. It has to do with how we value ourselves in relationship to other people. And the common way in English, the word conceit refers to thinking that we're somehow have a higher value than others. We are better than others in some ways. And so it's a form of comparative thinking. And as soon as we get involved in the comparative thinking of other people, this is really an amazing source of suffering. Comparative thinking, you know, things are constantly shifting in the social world and between us and our abilities and other people's abilities. And so, you know, if we expect to always have a higher evaluation of other people, we'll meet someone else who's going to be better. If, you know, I'm pretty good at basketball for someone who, you know, compared to the six-year-old next door, but not compared to most adult men at this point. And so do I hold on to that? Do I have a conceit around I'm a good basketball player, better than everyone else? You know, I'll probably just suffer around that kind of idea. And so this comparative thinking is an unnecessary glass door in the wilderness, in the natural setting. It mars the situation. It limits it. It becomes something then that we need to protect. We put fences around it. We put more and more fences and control for it. And it actually is a form of limiting ourselves rather than freeing ourselves. There's a wonderful cartoon from Calvin and Hobbes where Calvin is in the snow building a fort, and it's going to make himself safe in this fort. And he's building up the walls so it just goes above his head. And he's making it really tight and compact. And he surrounds himself with all this snow to make a good, safe fort for himself. But it's basically, he's made a round little cone around himself. And once it's all finished, he's trapped inside. And he says, "Help, help," because he can't get out anymore. So so this idea of conceit is can become a trap. We've kind of protected too much, and we kind of can't breathe even. Me, myself, and mine. The conceit of being better than. And in the ancient Buddhist language, ancient Buddhist teachings, a word which was closely related to mana, the word for conceit, is the word mada. And the mada means to be intoxicated, totally confused and wrapped up in things. And sometimes it's translated as pride, but the English word pride maybe has a variety of different meanings these days, and sometimes they're positive. But since the original meaning of this word mada is pride, is intoxication, one translation of ancient Abhidhamma text is to list all kinds of things people are intoxicated by. So intoxicated by their birth, by their caste, basically. Intoxicated by their clan. Intoxicated by their health. By youth. Intoxicated with life itself. Intoxicated with gain and acquisitions. Intoxicated with honor. With being respected, with fame, with having followers, with wealth, with skin color, with learning, with intelligence, with not being despised, accomplishments, popularity, with being ethical, with meditation attainments. And the list goes on and on, But each of these is seen as a kind of pride, a kind of conceit, and a conceit that we get intoxicated by or get caught by. And it's so much easier to be in life in the world without getting caught by these comparative thinking with others. One form of comparative thinking that in the Buddhist idea of conceit is also the idea of thinking that we're less than other people, that we have less value than others in some way. And that's also a conceit because it's also an attachment to an idea of self, attachment to a comparative way of thinking. And the solution is not to figure out a better way to compare. And even the idea of comparing ourselves as equals to others in Buddhism is considered to be part, you're still playing the comparison game. But rather, freedom is found by not comparing, by allowing ourselves and others to be just as they are in a much more. And so removing the door and the fences in the middle of the wilderness and letting that natural setting be itself. The third kind of conceit is the conceit of views, of philosophical opinions, beliefs about what is the true self, the essential self. And the Buddha said he knew at his time no belief in an essential self, a true self, that doesn't bring suffering. And I haven't done the analysis myself to see if that's really the case, but it's certainly a provocative idea that, and certainly we can say that any time we crave or cling to something, we will suffer. And so if we're clinging and craving to a view, an idea, my true self is my soul, my true self is my you know, inner goodness, my true self is my you know, whatever it might be, my consciousness. Is that going to give birth to suffering? Does it bring suffering when we're not in touch with that true self, when it's not evident and present? Does it just remain an idea that we have? And so the idea needs to be reinforced, needs to be reasserted in order to keep staying in touch with it, because maybe it can't be really felt and experienced. Or what about in deep meditation, when whatever we feel or experience as the essence of who we are falls away? Then some people get really frightened by this, because the deep, deep peace of meditation, where things just let go, we let go of all clinging. It's remarkable how wonderful that peace is, remarkable how liberating it can be, and how ordinary reference points for anything we have as we experience as myself dissolve. But some people get really frightened because that's who they think they are. I am this, and I have to be this. So selfishness, and the antidote to selfishness in Buddhism is certainly is to see the suffering of it. And sometimes it's only by seeing how painful it is and how fragile it is and how much energy goes into being selfish that people begin to loosen up and let go. But the other antidote is happiness, is to experience deep, abiding sense of happiness, well-being, contentment that doesn't require being selfish. And so that's one of the functions of meditation practice, is not only to become calm, not only to be mindful, but to acquire a sense of deeper contentment, satisfaction, ease, to be able to breathe easily, freely, without any clinging to selfishness, any kind of idea of me, myself, and mine. At least to give ourselves a radical break from it, so we don't come into meditation and hold on to these ideas of me, myself, and mine. Often the source, the fuel, for a lot of our preoccupied thinking is me, myself, and mine. And to let go of that so we can experience something really wonderful and to value this wonderful, beautiful, natural setting that we have, the natural capacity for ease and freedom and peace, and to learn how to wander freely, openly, in our own hearts, in our own minds, in our own life, without the glass door in the middle of it all, without the fences all around it, so it's unobstructed by it all, where we don't need to advertise ourselves or promote ourselves or explain to people who we are and assert ourselves on people as a form of clinging. And a sense of well-being. And one of the benefits of discovering such kind of well-being and peace and ease and letting go of all this is that then it also might be easier to stand up for oneself when society around you defines you. When society around you says you can't be that how you are, you have to be different, or you are in this kind of way. If we don't get, if we have our own stability inside and peace inside that we know, and we're not wrapped up around our identity issues, then in the way that this clinging is involves clinging, then it can be quite powerful to stand up for ourselves and say no to people. Not go along with what people are, how people are defining us, how other people's me, myself, and mine, you, yourself, and yours, is really oppressive for many people, and so the idea of really looking deeply at selfishness and how it works with me, myself, and mine, is also a gift, so that we don't project you, yourself, and yours onto others in ways that makes them oppressed. Imagine if we can live in a world where we don't put any fences around anyone. We don't put any glass doors that block anyone's path. Where we allow the people to be how they are. We allow the natural world to unfold in a beautiful way without the limitations and the problems of our clinging, especially the clinging to selfishness. May it be that this meditation practice shows us the limitations, shows us the suffering of our selfishness, so that we become more open, more free, more generous, more kind, more forgiving, and more, in a certain kind of way, natural. The kind of naturalness is there when there's no clinging. So I hope that gives you something to think about and to reflect on, and hopefully you're forgiving of yourself if you happen to have some conceit or some me, myself, and mine. But you might want to take a deeper look at this topic and make it a study for the week. This list that I read from the ancient texts about intoxicated. When I saw this list, I was kind of delighted that they, being intoxicated, preoccupied, caught up in things like health and youth and gain and honor, being respected, fame, having followers, our learning, accomplishments, popularity, all kinds of things. It's been going on for thousands of years. This is kind of what humans tend to do, especially when they come together. So if you're involved in some of it as well, you have a lot of company. And you have the company of the Buddha, of freedom. You have the company of yourself, perhaps in meditation, where you're beginning to loosen up and unstick yourselves from all forms of selfishness. May you let go of selfishness and find out how to be really happy in this life. Thank you.